Okay, good morning. You are listening to the Lowell Association for the Blind's LAB Radio. The Lab Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network, your main source of accessible community news and information. We're located in Lowell, Massachusetts. We read local news, editorials, feature stories, and more. The Lab Radio is brought to you by volunteers and staff of the Lowell Association for the Blind. Again, good morning. My name is David. I want to say good morning to Paul. Good morning to Paul.
Good morning, David. Welcome back. Haven't seen you in a while.
That's true. And Paul is going to read to you from today's Lowell Sun. I'm going to read to you from today's Eagle Tribune. We'd also like you to know that the lab would like to thank the Nancy L. and the Richard K. Donahue Charitable Foundation for their support. And I think I'm going to ask Paul to lead off.
Okay, so let's go with a front page story here. Not a great one, but it's the main headline, and it says, a man is accused of holding a woman captive. And it says that a Dracut man accused of holding a woman captive for hours, beating her and threatening to kill her when the two ran out of crack cocaine and was captured in Lowell after allegedly stealing her car. Kevin Nagarayewa, it's a hard name there, was arrested on December 28th in Lowell after the alleged assault. And police said that he fled from a stolen Hyundai Elantra and was caught following a brief chase. Officials later confirmed he was the same man wanted in Dracut on a warrant that included charges of kidnapping for extortion, assault and battery with a dangerous weapon, witness intimidation, and threatening to commit a crime. The warrant stemmed from a December incident where a 53-year-old Bill Ricker woman told police that she escaped his Regency Drive home after being held there for roughly 6 hours. According to Dracut police incident reports, she said she had gone to the house that morning to, not for breakfast, David, but to smoke crack cocaine with the Nagaria, who she had known for about 6 months. She claimed that Nagaria became angry when the drugs ran out and told him she did not have the money to buy more. The Bill Ricker resident alleged this is when the violence began. She told police that he began kicking and punching her, knocking her to the floor, stomped on her face numerous times, and numerous stomps to the head and the ribs. According to reports, she said he blocked the only exit from the bedroom that they were in, threatening to kill her and her family if she tried to leave. And he smashed her phone and glasses when she attempted to call for help. She also told officers that before damaging the phone, Nagaria had tried to use it to send himself $100 through Cash App, but the transfer did not go through. According to her account, he said, let's turn the page, you'll be lucky if you leave here alive. And she further alerts that during the alleged assault, he coerced her into performing a sexual act or threatening to hurt her further if she refused. Court records do show that no sexual assault charges were filed in this connection. The woman told police she eventually convinced him that he needed to go outside to meet her boyfriend for money, and once she stepped out of the bedroom, she fled from the home and made contact with the police. Police said in a report that the woman had bruising in her face and head, and in another report it states she was taken to Lowell General Saints Hospital campus for treatment of her injuries. Police subsequently obtained an arrest warrant for Nagaria, but he was not located in the weeks that followed. But at the end of December, according to a police incident report, a 2008 Honda Elantra was stolen after its owner left it parked and running on Market Street about 9:15 a.m., and surveillance footage captured the theft and also identified the suspect.
That's a mistake. Leaving your car running on Market Street. Okay, go ahead.
Anywhere, but especially not there. He said they spotted the Elantra on Appleton Street also, which is kind of after receiving a tip shortly after, of course, 2 a.m. in the morning, and they attempted to stop the vehicle, and the driver jumped out on Central Street and intentionally walked away before running when he saw a police cruiser. A foot chase ensued, the police said, and he was taken into custody and at first refused to provide his identity. But it was later confirmed by officers that it was Nagarya and learned that he was outstanding warrant in Draker. According to his legal woes, police said that he was not only driving a stolen vehicle, but doing so with a revoked license. In addition to the felony warrant out of Draker, he was charged in Lowell with receiving a stolen motor vehicle and operating after license revocation. He was to be arraigned in Lowell District Court on December 29th and ordered held without bail, pending a dangerousness hearing. Yeah. The hearing was held on Friday, at which time he was held without bail after the district attorney's office successfully argued that he posed a risk to the public. His attorney, Robin Gagne, declined to go into detail about the case, but did state after Friday's hearing that she believed there were discrepancies in the photographs of the woman's injuries. The photos are certainly not consistent with what the allegations are, she said. Of course, the suspect now will be scheduled to return to court for a pre-trial hearing on February 13th. So,
okay. Well, there you go. So the good news is he's locked up.
He's locked up.
And probably, hopefully, for another 20.
Yeah.
Really? Come on.
Yes.
Okay. Eagle Tribune, today's edition, Monday, January 5. And the lead article says, and this is coming out of Lawrence. It says, couple dead in apparent murder-suicide. Ooh. Again, it's coming out of Lawrence. A couple is dead after an apparent murder-suicide in an apartment at the 500 block of Essex Street on Saturday night. Authorities said it appears a man shot his girlfriend, then himself, during a 9 p.m. crime at 582 Essex Street, apartment 202. Eduardo Ramirez Sands, 30, and Edgar Joel Torres, 32, have been identified as the deceased. Essex County District Attorney Paul Tucker confirmed the events are under investigation and autopsies will be scheduled on Sunday. Family members told investigators there was a toxic history between the couple. Ramirez is believed to be the mother of several children, and the couple had been together several years and possibly married. Both were arrested after a September 1, 2018, shots fired called in the Beacon Projects, according to a previous report. Officers working in that area Saturday night heard 2 to 3 gunshots. Both Ramirez and Torres faced numerous firearms offenses at that time. And then it says, this is a developing story. Check back to the Eagle Tribune for updates. Okay, so that ends that article, which is pretty short on the front page. Okay, here's another article on the front page of the Eagle Tribune, and it says, why not the Patriots? And it's a question mark. And then it says below it in smaller print, let road to the Super Bowl begin. Mm. Okay, so this is coming out of Foxborough. Big boy football has finally returned to New England. And let's be honest, it's been a while. The Patriots had one of the softest schedules in recent memory this season, Exhibit A. But tomato cans aside, this team has played as well as anyone in the NFL through fall and into the winter. Week after week, we saw consistency, sharp execution, and a level of discipline that we haven't glimpsed since the last Lombardi Trophy was hoisted in February of 2019. Did anyone really expect this? Maybe in 2026. The rebuild was supposed to be a bit of a slog. Instead, it's been quick and tidy. A far cry from the stretch of 4-win misery that made the franchise look like it did pre-Belichick and pre-Brady. Give credit to the new coach and architect, Mike Vrabel. At $300,000 free agent spending spree, but this is more than talent, which includes the changeover in the coaching staff. I predicted 8 wins for this year. They got there by November 9. That was the day after another all-phases win on the road in Tampa when it became clear. Time to raise expectations big time. They've done it despite major injuries. Bonus baby left tackle Will Campbell, prize defensive signing Milton Williams, and anchor linebacker Robert Spillane all missed time. Other than a rough second half against the Bills on December 14, the wins just kept coming, including another tough one at home late yesterday afternoon. This Patriots defense isn't as dominant as some of the old units, especially against the run. But as we saw against the Dolphins, a team that came in hot, winners of 5 of 7, the Pats have something they haven't had in years, a quarterback who changes the game. That's Drake May. Sure, the stats were solid, 14 of 18, 190 yards a touchdown. But it was the way Drake May seized the moment. When the Patriots up 17 to 10, first play of the second half, he drops a 29-yarder to Hunter Henry. Six plays later, a perfect touch pass to Ramon Stevenson for a score. Game, set, match. And now, regular season in the books, the real season begins. The Patriots aren't the only team with a rapid rise. Denver, Jacksonville, Chicago all fit the mold, with Denver maybe a year ahead. All have big-time coaches and legit quarterbacks, but I'm not sure any pairing tops Rabel and May. This team is different. Unlike the old-school, militaristic Belichick regime, Rabel's squad feels looser, closer, and in some ways more likable. I've watched a lot of teams from the Foxborough press box, and this one stands apart. Is it hokey to call the Patriots a family? No way, said cornerback Christian Gonzalez, who was arguably the best player on the past 4-win teams. When you care about the guy next to you, it means so much more. Does it work in January? Why not? Every team is good, as in good, not great. We got the right guys in the building at the right time, and we got good quarterback play. We figured out how not to beat ourselves. I think we play to an identity, and guys make plays. That's what happens. Next weekend, the Chargers come to town. Same coach, Jim Harbaugh. Same quarterback, Justin Herbert. The duo that smoked the Pats 40-7 at Gillette just last December. But for the first time since the Brady era, the Patriots have the pieces, a running game, a defense that forces turnovers, and yes, an MVP quarterback who gives you a shot every week. I'm not calling it Super Bowl or bust, but to borrow a line from Kevin Garnett, with this team and this quarterback, anything is possible. Yeah, wow. There's some excitement, you know, on Sundays.
That guy's optimistic.
Yeah. You know, I do think they'll beat the Chargers.
I would think so.
My only concern is if Buffalo continues to win and the Patriots continue to win and they meet, I'm concerned about Buffalo.
Yes, I would be too.
All right.
So there you go.
I'll turn it back to you.
There's also a front page story, which is actually somewhat good news, I believe. And it says crime is down 14% on the MBTA from last year. And this represents incidents between January 1st and December 15th. For 2024 and 2025. Crime is down on the T, commonly known as the T, by about 14% from last year, according to the system's police department. This reduction in crime is indicative of my officers coming day in, day out, working tirelessly to ensure our system is safe for riders, says Transit Authority Chief of Police Kenneth Green. The T police work in the cities and towns that the MBTA serves, but most of the incidents they respond to are in Boston, of course. When presenting the data, Green looked at Part 1 crimes, which includes homicides, which has been zero for the last 2 years, rapes or assaults, robberies, aggravated assaults, burglaries, etc., and auto thefts. And the data represented incidents between January 1st and December 15th, for both years. The largest decreases by percentage in raw numbers were in the categories of robberies and larcenies, which are down 26% and 20% respectively from 2024. Rapes and assaults to rape are up by 50%. But in raw numbers, this is one more than last year, which Green said is on a par with the T's average at about 3 per year. There was also a slight uptick in aggravated assaults, more than last year, a 2% increase to 193 incidents from 190 in 2024. This category is pretty broad, says Green, explaining that it goes from everything from spitting to a terrible physical assault. When you look at our trips per month, we do millions of people, Green says, and I don't want to minimize anyone being assaulted or raped or whatever, but it's not out of control by any sense of the imagination. Green explained that those numbers include assaults on T workers, although he didn't have exact numbers on this issue. In the coming year, to help T police respond faster to these series of incidents and others, a police control center will be outfitted in Quincy that will allow the department to work alongside MBT operations. T police also plan on hiring more officers in 2026. Changes to civil service, the rules that govern police hiring processes, are now allowing the department to hire from a more diverse pool of applicants. The academy class that starts next spring will have 30 prospects, he said, the largest recruiting class in over a decade. A new contract with officers also raised pay and will help retain more officers. Still, the department has 217 officers now and would be fully staffed at 278, he said. The decrease in crime comes as the T tries to ramp up its service to pre-pandemic levels. The MBTA saw its best average weekday ridership numbers since COVID in October, with pretty much close to a million rides across all modes, including buses, commuter rail, ferries, and paratransit service for people with disabilities. These ridership increases ran parallel to improvements on the service in all of its T lines. In an October letter to the U.S. Department of Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy, who may have once taken the T when he was on the original Real World Boston season, must be a TV show, the MBTA's general manager, Philip Ng, touted the agent's in safety and increased service. Ng is also the interim head of MassDOT. As we make our system safe and more accessible, we are making transit not just an option, but the preferred choice, Ng wrote. At the time, the U.S. Department of Transportation had been requesting safety data from transit systems around the country following the fatal stabbing of a Ukrainian refugee on a North Carolina train over the summer. The Trump administration had also tossed around the idea of a federal takeover of South Station, which it had already done with Washington, D.C.'s Union Station. Ng cited lower crime numbers in the letter to Duffy, writing that it was all important that, quote, all riders must be safe and feel safe while using any part of our network. So, sounds like some good news there on the T.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Paul. All right. Here's an article on page 2 of the Eagle Tribune. I don't know if it's being directed to you, Paul.
Okay.
It says, it's the perfect time to reassess your finances. Okay. This is by Joan Hayden Roy, and she happens to be the executive director of AgeSpan. So here's what she writes, or here's the question, and I guess she gives an answer. Question. It seems like every week I get invited to another free financial seminar. Do you get invited to financial seminars?
I do.
I do too. And they offer you all these meals.
Free food.
I never go.
I don't.
I've never gone to one, but I always have been curious. Are they a good way for a retiree to get good financial advice? I want to keep a better track of my investments in the new year. All right, here's the answer. January is the National Financial Wellness Month. Who knew that?
Didn't know.
A perfect time. How about every day is a perfect time? A perfect time to pause and think about what's working and what could be improved with your finances. How about spend less? How about just that, you know?
Yeah, save more.
Yeah, save more, spend less, right. Who needs to go to a dinner for, you know, just get up there and say that. Save more, spend less, you know. Okay. It's understandable to be curious about retirement seminars. Many people wonder whether they're really worth the attending. Well, I think if you think about the free food, maybe.
That's it.
The truth is, while some offer useful information, many that are advertised as educational or workshops are actually focused on selling investments. You know, selling investments, insurance, or other financial products, either during the event or in a follow-up calls. You know that's the case. There are no free lunches. You've heard that before,
right? I have heard that.
Okay. Mm-hmm. That's why it helps to know the common red flags before you attend. Here is a list from the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau. Freebies. Financial salespeople may offer a free meal or a gift to you to attend. They're hoping that by giving you something, you'll be more likely to give them something in return. High-pressure sales tactics. You may be asked to act quickly or told that the opportunities are limited. Good advisors won't rush you. Exaggerated claims. If someone promises you big returns, do you know who promised big returns? Bernie Madoff. Do you remember him?
Oh, yeah, this Ponzi scheme.
Yeah, the Ponzi scheme. He promised big returns, like, I guarantee you 12% a year. Nobody looked into his financials, where your money was going, you know.
That's why you had to pay close attention yourself.
If someone promises you big returns with little risk, be cautious. Report misleading statements to your state securities or insurance regulators. How about misleading titles? Titles like senior specialist. That's impressive. May sound official, but check credentials before trusting anyone with your money. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau recommends asking for references and getting a background report before hiring anyone to be a financial advisor. You can do some research ahead of time by visiting the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission website. As we start a new year, it's a great time to set intentions for your financial wellness. If you do attend a seminar, remember you're under no obligation to buy anything or share personal information. Take your time, ask questions, and trust your instincts. For guidance you can count on, look to unbiased educational resources and advisors who put your interests first. And then it says, so that's the end of it. Then she says, are you caring for an older adult or need help finding healthy aging resources? Our experienced staff is available. This is at AgeSpan. To help, visit us online at www.agespan.org, or you can call us at 800-892-0890 or email info@agespan.org. You know, that is available. AgeSpan is available for seniors that need some kind of assistance. You just have to make the phone call.
Because some seniors are vulnerable and easily influenced by these sales pitches.
I get them all the time.
Yeah, I do too. And
I just rip them up and, you know, because
I'm happy with our financial arrangements.
You make the money, you give it to your wife.
Yeah, well,
something like that.
Yeah,
right?
You know, it's, yeah, as long as you keep an eye on your investments and make good choices, you should be all right.
Yeah. I mean, I love it when in the Wall Street Journal today, it said that Wall Street is thinking that this could still be another good year for investing in the stock market, that there's still room for growth.
Mm. Yeah.
Who knows that? You know what I'm saying? They always tell you, oh, yeah, Don't know. Rely on your own instincts.
Yep.
Right?
I think so. But I don't know. Just don't give any numbers over the phone or anything like that. You know.
Or go up to Seabrook, right?
Oh, Seabrook.
Huh?
That's a guaranteed investment right there.
Nobody knows what you do up in Seabrook.
No.
You know, isn't there a place you can bet on the ponies?
Yes, there is. And whatever else you want to bet on.
Yeah.
So,
I'll turn it back to you, Paul.
So we'll go with the local news story. The Joan Stylianos here comes out of New Hampshire. And the headline is former Merrimack, New Hampshire Budweiser plant may be put on ice, she says. Hold your horses. The Clydesdales, that is. Merrimack, a vibrant community of about 30,000 residents, has been dominating headlines lately. The famous Anheuser-Busch beer brewing facility located near the Nashua Line, which opened in 1970 and quickly became a major employer in southern New Hampshire for several decades, and the major Anheuser-Busch distribution hub for New England and the Northeast, is on the chopping block. This Buds for You no longer applies. The news that the plant would suddenly cease operations by February has caught many by surprise. The massive facility sits on about 300 acres, and the company is taking steps to update and modernize its U.S. infrastructure. Unfortunately, 124 employees here would be impacted by the shutdown. The other curious headline came from the Washington Post on Christmas Eve and has folks across southern New Hampshire baffled. ICE documents reveal plan to hold 80,000 immigrants in warehouses. And the article went on to state that the Trump administration aims to build 7 large-scale holding centers to speed up deportations, internal ICE documents show. Additionally, the article displayed a map and 16 smaller warehouses would hold up to 1,500 people each. Merrimack was named to the smaller warehouse list, according to internal U.S. and Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, documents. Oddly, no one gave up Merrimack the heads up, including its town manager, Paul McKaylee. The phone continues to ring off the hook at town hall, but it's a waiting game and there's little he can say. We have had no prior knowledge of a warehouse for Merrimack. McKaylee hopes for answers as Congress returns today from Christmas recess. Social media has been abuzz with rumors that Merrimack's ICE warehouse could end up in the Anheuser-Busch facility, and some think that the sudden shutdown of the brewing company is suspicious. That's incredulous. A detention center at the former home of the Budweiser Clydesdales and Company. Whichever industrial facility is chosen would have to be extensively modified to include housing units, showers, dining facilities, medical areas, and recreation space. Some people don't want ICE hitching its wagon to the Granite State, especially the Nashua area, because the federal agency is allegedly detaining individuals unlawfully, denies due process, separates families, and exhibits a lack of human decency. New Hampshire State Rep. Rosemary Rung has called Merrimack her home since 1983, and she and her husband, John, chose to raise their family here because the town has a wonderful hometown feel. It's a community that builds family. We take care of each other, Rung tells me. We've been at our wits' end about plans for a human warehouse here. We're not the kind of community that reflects that type of behavior. Rung says it's time for Governor Kelly Ayotte to stand up to the Trump administration and ICE and tell them, take New Hampshire off your map. I asked Time Manager McCallie what would happen if ICE issued an order to make one of Merrimack's former industrial warehouses an immigrant detention and processing center. And he tells me that town officials would regroup. We would discuss with our legal team about what we can or cannot do, McCallie said. Meantime, McCallie said that the Anheuser-Busch facility is a huge loss. The site, located at 221 Daniel Webster Highway, which is off Route 3, sits on a major road in Merrimack, near the Everett Turnpike, and is a prime piece of property. Whatever eventually takes over that industrial-zoned land, McCallie hopes it's something that allows Merrimack to continue to succeed and prosper. So, we'll still see.
Okay, back to the Eagle Tribune. I'm on page 3. Excuse me. It says here, if you're into birds, okay? This is an article for bird lovers, bird watchers. Excuse me. Christmas bird count results hold surprises. The 2025 Newburyport Christmas bird count was held the Sunday before Christmas on December 21. 17 teams scoured a 15-mile radius circle. Some starting at 4:30 in the morning, searching for owls, and all ended at 4:40 p.m., more than 12 hours later. The weather was partly sunny with winds 15 to 25 miles an hour, putting the wind chill near freezing. Compiler Tom Young commented that the numbers of birds were generally down, and no species were present in record numbers. I wonder why. Maybe there's a few hawks running around?
Yeah, it could be.
There were two species, Ross's goose and western kingbird. I never heard of Ross's goose.
No, never heard of that.
And how about western kingbird?
No, I'm learning that there's so many varieties of birds I can't keep up with it.
That were first records for the count, and a Vesper sparrow. I don't know what a Vesper. I know what a sparrow is. Isn't a sparrow a sparrow?
Well, I guess there are different types of sparrows.
I guess a Vesper was found for only the third time in the count's history. How would you know? I mean, is it because they got a little more hair on the top of their bill
probably
or something?
Some marking or color, I imagine.
The two Ross geese. I don't know why they're called Ross geese. We're on the Hellcat Dyke on Plum Island. Now we're going to talk about, what was the name? What color was that house on going
the pink
out?
House.
Pink house. It's no longer there, right?
It's gone.
It's gone. You know, you've driven by?
Oh, yeah. I went up there the day before it was bulldozed down. I took pictures.
Well, you said before.
Yeah.
Have before. You been there after?
Yes, I have. And there's nothing there.
Nothing. It's just, let's see. So the two Ross geese, where they had, I thought geese are geese.
I guess not.
You know, I mean, where they had been present for more than 2 weeks. The western kingbird was found by Jay Fontero at Spencer Pierce Little Farm in Newbury. Likely the same bird that was seen and photographed with a scissor-tailed. Oh, this is how you know. Mm-hmm. The scissor-tailed flycatcher. What? Boy, these people must have really good eyes, huh?
Well, bird watching, I think it's a huge...
Well, you got to have binoculars, You have to have binoculars that are like on a stand.
Yes.
Because if you're holding it in your hand, you ever hold binoculars in your hand?
Yeah.
There's a little bit of a shake.
Some people use... high-powered cameras to look through and put it on a stand.
Okay, so this guy photographed, his name is Dave Larson, and he says, unfortunately, the scissor tail flycatcher wasn't found on the count. Hmm. The The only other geese found on the count were 2,703 Canada geese. Wait a minute. Are you telling me that people are counting them? How are you not sure you're not counting the same one that just flew, you know, a few feet over to the right, and yeah. you're counting them again?
I don't know. They're just keeping a wreck. I don't know.
Why don't you go join one of these expeditions and find out how they do? I mean, how do you not count the same one? They all looked alike, right?
Yeah, and make a mess of the golf courses.
I was just going to say that. I've been at golf courses, and it's like, oh, my God. Okay, 18 swans were in the harbor.
Ooh.
Okay, I think you can count up to 18 Ooh. And not double count them, right? Yeah. Possible. But 2,703 Canada geese. And people say Canadian geese, right? It's Canada geese, yeah. right? And then they said there, 18 swans were in the harbor. Oh, come on. And 1,328 common eiders, E-I-D-E-R-S?
I think a duck.
On the ocean, leading the duck numbers yeah. on the count. You're right.
Yeah, that's. I knew that was a duck.
800 black ducks. How do people keep this record so they're not recounting them 10 times the same duck?
I suppose they want to make sure that the population isn't declining or something. Or
No. I understand that why you're maybe doing the count.
Yeah.
But how do you not prevent yourself from double counting the same duck flying 10 feet, 10 feet, 10 feet, and go, oh, there's three different ducks? No, it's the same duck.
That is, yeah, it must be a method.
Okay, so 800 black ducks. I didn't know they were called black ducks. 431 common golden eye. Now, if I take it literally, golden eye, that means their eyes are like gold. How do you get that close? And then they got two eyes. Do you make sure you don't double count?
Yeah, maybe they have yellow, like yellow. They call it golden, but it's yellow or something.
Then they got other names here. There was enough to open water for the pintail, the shovelers, and the hooded mergansers to be found. I wouldn't even know what they're talking about.
No.
Okay, here we go. Wild turkey numbers seem low at 68. And the mourning doves. Oh, yeah, we see mourning doves all the time.
Yeah.
Mourning doves outnumbered rock pigeons. I thought pigeons and doves were the same thing. Did you?
I think pigeons are bigger than doves, aren't they?
Okay, so the doves are the babies.
The small ones, you know.
I mean, could you imagine I'm with someone in this group? I'm like, how do you know it's a pigeon versus a dove? And oh my God, I know they would say, don't even come, because I'd say, how do you know you're not double counting, triple counting the same bird? Okay. Then they had 14 red-throated loons.
Oh, loons. Okay.
Loons. Okay. A Wilson snipe was seen on Plum Island during the count week. Herring gulls were everywhere with 7,141 counted. Oh, come on. And along with 422 ring-billed gulls and 51 great black-backed gulls. Black-backed gulls. Who knew? Are you interested in this story? It gets better. It really does get better. How do you even have enough paper to write all these things now? Four great blue herons. This is crazy. This has got to be a joke. We're still braving the winter weather, as were eight turkey vultures. Oh, turkey vultures. Only two double-crested Cormorants?
Cormorants, yeah.
Cormorants?
They're seabirds.
Oh, I didn't know. You know that. You
could qualify. I knew a little bit about it.
You could qualify. Red-tailed hawks. There we go. Here's why the count is down. The red-tailed hawks led the hawk numbers with 48 counted. Ooh. 18 bald eagles were seen on the count day, and that number should climb as more water freezes up north. 23 harriers were counted, 16 Cooper's hawks, 3 sharp shine hawks, 1 red-shouldered hawk, 1 rough-legged hawk were found. You have to be a brilliant person to know all the different types of birds and then to know what they look like, right?
Yep.
Owls, that's... Okay, I know what owls are. I think I'd like to have owls, wouldn't you?
Well, usually they're near a barn or some lot of trees, right?
I think you're thinking of all the movies.
It could be, yes.
Owls were represented with 7 screech. Oh, that's the name of it? 7 screech?
Screech.
4 barred, 3 great horned, 3 short eared, and 1 saw wet owl. One snowy owl was added during the count. Okay, here we go. Downy woodpeckers. I thought woodpeckers are woodpeckers. This is downy woodpeckers. Topped the woodpecker number at 170 with relative newcomer, the red-bellied woodpecker, numbering 66. 41 northern flickers were found, along with 19 hairy and 4 pileated woodpeckers, 7 yellow-bellied sapsuckers. Come on. Are you telling me that they can tell? How about, all right, I tell you what, Paul, all right, I'm not trying to be too facetious, but even though I am, could they please tell me which ones are male and which ones are female? Can they tell me?
They probably can by the feathers.
American crows. I got a lot of crows in my neighborhood. Okay. I got a lot of crows.
I can't stand crows.
American crows totaled 748. Fish crows. I didn't know there were American crows. Fish crows and ravens. Blue jays numbered. I haven't seen many blue jays.
I've seen a few in my cul-de-sac area.
Blue jays numbered 228 to round out the corvids. Corvids. What are corvids? Birds?
Must be a set of birds.
Okay. European starling. We've had those in the spring and the fall. They appear and then they disappear.
Yep.
European starling topped the numbers at 3,300 and also introduced counterparts, the house sparrow. And the house finches. I have house, I guess. I have sparrows and finches. The black-capped chickadees led the native parade of feeder birds, though not always seen at feeders. Then they had juncos. You've heard of juncos?
No.
Yeah. Goldfinch?
Goldfinch.
Yep. Robins?
Yep.
Robins. Tufted titmice. I've heard of that.
Yep.
Cardinals.
Yep.
White-throated sparrows. White-breasted nuthatch.
Nuthatch. I've heard of nuthatch.
Then they said eastern bluebirds, tree sparrows, and 105 Carolina wrens. Boy, people, can you imagine what's going on with the bird watches? You can't imagine the person next to you, the knowledge that they probably have, right?
No, that's...
So it is true when you say to someone, hey, you're a bird brain, right?
Bird brain, yeah. You know all the
species. You know
it.
You know, we used to say if you're a bird brain, you're kind of like, you don't have a brain.
Yeah.
Right? But this has a different...
Knowledge of birds.
Yeah. Let's see. Only a few winter finches were discovered, with 10 pine siskins, 3 purple finches, and 1 red crossbill being recorded. In total, 111 species were found. That's incredible. 111 different
species,
right? Were found. I would have rather they just said, yes, we found this, as a given me a count, because
Yeah.
Who's count? I don't care. Individuals total 24,611 birds. Now, if you're out there on a bird watch and you're following 24,000 birds, right? Do you think there's a possibility that one of them just may strike you with some of his?
Oh, yes, 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 yes.
You know?
Yeah, I think you should wear a hat.
And then it says, wishing everybody a happy new year filled with cool birds and wondrous bird experiences. Can you imagine if I came in the house and I said to my wife, I just saw all these different species of birds. She'd look at me like, where are you from?
Yeah.
You know, right?
Yeah. I mean, that's, I guess everybody's got their own hobbies, you know.
Well, you got to have a lot of knowledge also, yeah, right? And they said it was also very cold.
And just remind me, where was this location again?
Newburyport. So when it's you're out there looking for that pink house and you don't find it.
That's a big bird.
Yeah, that's
area.
A big area to walk around.
For the birds. They love it up there.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's interesting.
So, you know, based on that, I think we're going to take our break. Okay.
Yep.
So, let me give you some information here. We'd like you to know that you're listening to the Lowell Association for the Blind's LAB Radio. The Lab Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. The Lab would like to thank UMass Lowell's WUML-FM for providing the radio signal that allows us to broadcast 5 days a week. I'm going to switch you back to Marshfield Broadcasting, and at 11:15, Paul and I will be back to read more local news from the Lowell Sun and the Eagle Tribune. So bye-bye for now.
The reality of how Washington will administer that country in the weeks and months ahead.
Okay, computer's on. We are back, and again, you're listening to the Lowell Association for the Blind's LAB Radio. And Paul has been reading the Lowell Sun, today's Lowell Sun. I've been reading, I'm reading the Eagle Tribune. We just finished reading that nice article about birds in Newburyport. So, Paul, I'll let you lead off our second half.
Okay, good. So I'm sure that most of the listeners have heard about the situation in Venezuela. And there's an article here which doesn't describe exactly what happened there, but it looks into it a little bit for the future. And it says that U.S. intervention could test Trump's ability to hold the GOP together in an election year. President Donald Trump's military intervention in Venezuela will post a fresh test of his ability to hold together a restive Republican coalition during a challenging election year that could be defined by domestic concerns like health care and affordability. While most Republicans lined up behind the president in the aftermath of the stunning U.S. mission to capture Venezuelan leader Nicolas Maduro and bring him to New York to face criminal charges, there were signs of unease across the spectrum within the party. In particular, Trump's comments about the U.S. positioning itself to, quote, run Venezuela have raised concerns that he is abandoning the America First philosophy that has long distinguished him from more traditional Republicans and helped fuel his political rise. This is the same Washington playbook that we are so sick and tired of that doesn't serve the American people, but actually serves the big corporations, the banks, and the oil executives, says Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene of Georgia, a former Trump ally who is resigning on Monday in an interview with NBC's Meet the Press on Sunday. These concerns were shared by some who are not associated with the party's far-right flank. Representative Brian Fitzpatrick of Pennsylvania, a moderate who is one of the most vulnerable Republicans in the November midterms, said in a statement that the only country that the United States of America should be running is the United States of America. Those comments reflect the sensitive dynamics between Trump and his fellow Republicans at the outset of an election year in which their party risks losing control of Congress. While the president's dominance remains undisputed, the ironclad grip that he has held over the party has faced unusual challenges in recent months. Blocks of Republicans have banded together to pressure Trump to release the Jeffrey Epstein files, and others have been vocal in encouraging Trump to take concerns about affordability more seriously. Trump's aggressive vision of U.S. dominance. Few issues are as central to Trump's political brand as ensuring that the U.S. does not get entangled in seemingly endless foreign conflicts at the expense of domestic goals. During a 2016 Republican presidential debate, for instance, he described the war in Iraq as a, quote, big fat mistake. But on Saturday, Trump said he was not afraid of boots on the ground in Venezuela if that was deemed necessary, and he framed his actions as prioritizing the safety and security of Americans. He articulated an aggressive vision of U.S. dominance in the Western Hemisphere, and he told reporters it was important to surround ourselves with good neighbors. However, much like the Iraq War, a president's early confidence after a dramatic military action can sometimes meet more sobering realities that drain domestic political support. In Venezuela, U.S. troops could be placed in harm's way again, as Trump warns that more military operations may be in the works. An ongoing conflict could worsen the hemisphere's refugee crisis, something the White House has tried to tamp down with stricter border controls. In addition, there are questions about how much cooperation the U.S. will receive from officials still in Venezuela and how easily the country's oil reserves could be tapped to fulfill Trump's goal of extracting more energy with Maduro out of the picture. Trump's comments this weekend about revitalizing the oil industry in Venezuela are in line with some of the earliest critiques he made of the handling of the Iraq War. During a 2013 speech before the Conservative Political Action Conference, Trump said the U.S. should take oil from Iraq and pay ourselves back. So frustration with the handling of the Iraq War contributed to major gains for Democrats in 2006 and helped create the conditions for Barack Obama to be elected to the presidency 2 years later. Given the baggage surrounding those wars, Trump allies insist that the actions this weekend in Venezuela are different. Venezuela looks nothing like Libya, Secretary of State Marco Rubio said on Meet the Press. It looks nothing like Iraq. It looks nothing like Afghanistan. It looks nothing like the Middle East other than the Iranian agents that are running through there plotting against America today. Okay. So, time will tell.
Yep. Okay, here's an article in the Eagle Tribune. I'm on page 3. It says, an uncommon endeavor. And it reads, while Russia and Ukraine seem at a crossroads in the news, yet no closer to peace, there is one constant in the lives of many Ukrainians since the war began 4 years ago. A team of New Hampshire people show up delivering food and toys for children in hope for the future. Really? Hmm. The common man for the Ukrainian team, Lisa Murr, Alex Ray, Susan Matheson, and Steve Rand, Plymouth Rotarians, I guess part of the Rotary Club,
right? Yeah.
Recently returned from their 14th humanitarian mission to the Ukraine. Hmm. These people go to Ukraine. Wow. I mean, that's a war zone.
Yep, it is.
The mission also sponsors respite child trauma counseling retreats in Poland for 35 children a month whose fathers have died in the war. How sad. And for the first time, the team visited this month a retreat for 16 widows of the war. Wow. Mm. They're doing God's work. The December trips are special because of the holiday, said Lisa Murr. So we wore Santa hats when we were delivering food and gifts for the children in the southeast corner of Ukraine, Ukraine, down near the front. Wow. Hmm. Filling bags with food for a Ukrainian woman during the recent humanitarian mission. Not a lot of aid groups are willing to go in the region because of the danger. I understand that.
Hmm.
It was nice. We sang Christmas carols, and they do know Jingle Bells. They did sing along and got a lot of really big, strong hugs. They're just so grateful that they're not forgotten and that we brought food. Even beyond the food, they are so amazed that we come all the way from America just to bring them some sustenance and a little bit of fun and comfort, so it was really great. There was a lot of war action while they were there this trip, and they could have made it more frightening. We've become like the Ukrainians. You just get used to it, she said. I don't know how you get used to it.
Yeah.
At a store buying some bags, they asked some young people who were helping them translate what it was like living in the war, with war. Do they worry every night? They just shrug and say, it is what it is, is it? It says, what is what it is? There is nothing we can do. We go on with our lives. That's the sort of thinking we've embraced as well. You don't stop living, Muir said. That is very Ukrainian. They don't wallow in misery. They don't feel sorry for themselves. Oh, these are really stoic people, huh?
Yeah, they are.
The volunteers handed out Beanie Babies, donated by people in New Hampshire, and peace dolls that were made by the Laconia Community Church Women's Group, and thousands of knitted hats from around the state and the country. Common Man for Ukraine volunteers sing Jingle Bells with children between 8 and 12 at the trauma counseling and retreat for children whose fathers were killed in the war. The trip started in Poland, where they visited child trauma counseling retreat for 35 children between the ages of 8 and 12 whose fathers were killed in the war. They handed out candy, Beanie Babies, peace dolls, solar lanterns, and sang Christmas carols. The team also visited for the first time a widow's retreat for women whose husbands were killed in the war. Lore, who was surprised by one mother's comment about the retreat for her child. She said, my child got to eat breakfast with an American. It was really cool, Muir said. Ukrainian children opened presents, including hand-knit hats from New Hampshire and across the country. Alex Ray, the owner of the Common Man restaurant.
I know the Common Man. Yeah.
So that's how they got their name. Common Man for Ukraine. Alex Ray, owner of the Common Man restaurants, whose idea helped launch the Common Man for Ukraine project, said that what struck him, during this latest mission was the older women and how happy they were to get help they badly needed. The men are at war, so you mostly see women and children. They are so alone and so old and sad, but grateful for the food they receive and for the hugs from caring volunteers. On this trip, a filmmaker came along to shoot a mini documentary of their work. I'd like to see that. The group all compliment the local volunteers. Many of them are Polish Rotarians, who drive the convoys filled with food for those in the remote villages. Their volunteer convoy crossed into the Ukraine on December 12, and 15 trucks delivered 44,000 pounds of food to 18 villages in eastern Ukraine. They also provided several tons of additional supplies, including more than 4,000 handmade knit hats from New Englanders and knitters across America, and more than 6,000 holiday presents for their kids. You don't even think about it. The way they are living.
Yeah, it's a war zone. Under attack. Yeah.
Wow. All in all, this convoy provided food, supplies, and cheer to more than 10,000 people in those villages. And the team returned home to New Hampshire days before Christmas, Santa and helpers filling bags with food in war-torn Ukraine. Susan Matheson said it may look like she, Muir, Ray, and Rand are the faces of the humanitarian effort, but it really is the work of the thousands of people across the country in New Hampshire who donate to make the mission happen. Once you start this work and see the situation, it's impossible to look away, Matheson said. And the thousands of people waiting in need, you can't say, I'm tired, I'm scared. The people are waiting and need food and sleeping bags and have an overwhelming ocean of need. Thousands of Americans send the money, trusting us to help the Ukrainians, Matheson said. Now for the group, just days after returning, the fundraising continues to support the mission number 15 that will begin in March. More information about donating to the Common Man for Ukraine can be obtained at commonmanforukraine.org/donate. All right.
Okay.
Back to you, Paul.
All right, so it's kind of a tragic tale here from the World News Nation section, and it comes out of Switzerland, and maybe people have heard about what happened. Is the headline is Hundreds March in Silence to Honor the Victims of the Swiss Bar Fire. This comes out of Kranz, Montana, Switzerland. Hundreds marched in silence on Sunday to honor the victims of the New Year's Eve fire at a bar in the Swiss Alpine resort of Kranz, Montana, which left 40 people dead and many severely injured. Somber mourners, many with reddened eyes, filed silently out of the chapel to organ music after the hour-long mass at the Chapelle St. Christophe in the Kranz, Montana region. Some exchanged hugs before marching up a hill to Le Constellation Bar. Many hundreds of people walked in the dense, sneaking procession in the bright sunlight past shuttered stores. Up on the mountain overlooking the town, snow machines sent plumes of white flakes into the air. At the top of the street in front of Le Constellation, which is still largely shielded from view by white screens, the swelling crowd stood in near total silence, some weeping. Then they broke into sustained applause for the rescue teams and police, who rushed to the scene of the horror, their hands in gloves and mittens against the cold. Mourners and well-wishers deposited bouquets at a makeshift memorial, piled with flowers, cuddly toys, and other tributes. Some firefighters wiped their eyes, too. Through this tragic event, I believe we must all remember that we are all brothers and sisters in humanity, said Veronique Barras, a local resident who knows the grieving families, and said, it's important to support each other, to hug each other, and to move forward towards light. Kathy Premer said her daughter was out celebrating her 17th birthday on New Year's Eve when she called in the early hours of the morning to say she was stuck because Le Constellation was cordoned off. For the young, but even for adults, it's hard to understand things that seem inexplicable, she said. They went there to party. It's a destination, December 31st. It's very festive. There were people of many nationalities, and it all turned into a tragedy. In the crowd, Paolo Ponti Greppi, an 80-year-old Italian who has a house in Kranz, Montana, called for safety checks in the bars. We need more safety in these places because it's not the only place like this. Why didn't the town do the proper checks? For me, that's terrible. During the mass for the victims, the Reverend Giles Gavin spoke of the terrible uncertainty for families unsure if their loved ones are among the dead or still alive or amongst the injured. There are no words strong enough to express the dismay, the anguish, and anger of those who are affected in their lives today. And yet, here we are, gathered because silence alone is not enough. In the crowded pews, a grieving woman listens intently, her hands clasped tightly and sometimes clasping rosary beads, as speakers delivered readings in German, French, and Italian. 40 people died and 119 were injured in this blaze that broke out around 1:30 in the morning. And police said many of the victims were in their teens to mid-20s. One of the victims was 16-year-old Arthur Brodard, whose mother had been frantically searching for him. Our Arthur has now left to party in paradise, a visibly shaken Leticia Brodard said in a Facebook story posted on Saturday night, speaking into a camera. We can start our mourning knowing that he is in peace and in the light. Brodard's frenzied search for her son reflected the desperation of families of the young people disappeared during the fire, who did not know whether their loved ones were dead or in the hospital. Swiss authorities said the process of identifying victims was particularly hard because of the advanced degree of the burns requiring the use of DNA samples. Brodard also had given her DNA sample to help in the identification process. In her Facebook post, she thanked those who testified their compassion, their love, and to those who shared information, as she anxiously searched and waited for news of her son. Other parents and siblings are still waiting in anguish. Swiss authorities finally have opened a criminal investigation of the bar managers. The two are suspected of involuntary homicide, involuntary body harm, and involuntarily causing a fire, the Valais region chief prosecutor Beatrice Pilloud told reporters on Saturday. The announcement of the investigation did not name the managers in question. So, what a horrible show that story that was.
Okay, back to the Eagle Tribune. It says Merrimack Valley Chamber networking breakfast. This is coming out of Haverhill. The Merrimack Valley Chamber of Commerce invites folks to make connections and build valuable business relationships at the networking breakfast from 9 in the morning to 9, excuse me, from 8 in the morning to 9:15 in the morning on Wednesday, January 14th. So that's a week from Wednesday at Merrimack Corner, 98 Water Street in Haverhill. Enjoy complimentary breakfast and an opportunity to connect with business leaders throughout the region. Oh, wait a minute. It says complimentary breakfast. Then it says members can enter for $10 while future members pay $20. So that's not free.
No.
Register for this event at 978-686-0900 or at the MerrimackValleyChamber.com. Okay, next one. Lawrence Heritage 250th birthday. It's coming out of Lawrence. Lawrence Heritage State Park is preparing for the observance of the United States 250th birthday. Inviting folks to 2 days of celebratory events at 1 Jackson Street at Canal. That must be in Lawrence. This will be the 20th annual old-fashioned 4th of July at the park. Festivities will start, did it say when? When? Doesn't say when. Okay, wait a minute. Festivities will start at 11 in the morning on Friday, July 3. Wow, that's way in advance getting this notice.
July.
with a visit from, guess who's coming? Abigail Adams. Reenacted.
Oh, reenacted.
You didn't really think she was coming out from the grave, did you?
No.
Who will share
for a minute, everyone.
Who will share her experiences during the American Revolution, followed by a light luncheon. You have to pay for that. Mm. At 11 in the morning on Saturday, July 4, the Live Oak Jazz Band will perform. There will be a customary flag raising at noon, followed by a singing of the national anthem, brief oratory by public officials, of course, you have to have the public officials. They have to have, they need to be seen.
Yeah, of course.
Yep. A parade around the park, public reading of the Declaration of Independence, a buffet luncheon and raffles. Does it cost for this? A buffet luncheon? Throughout the 2-day celebration, there will be a trivia contest regarding the history of Lawrence Heritage State Park as it prepares for its 40th annual celebration on September 1, 2026. During June and July, there will be not one, but two exhibits of the 1976 U.S. Bicentennial memorabilia on display at Lawrence Heritage. Historian and Summer Park interpreter, Richard Padova, will have his collection displayed on the first floor of the building, while historian Tom Spitaler will have his collection on the third floor. All activities are both days are free and open to the public. Boy, this is in July. You got to put this on your calendar.
Way ahead.
All right, this I think is going to be of interest to you. The next one, all right, Paul?
Okay.
The Taste of Haverhill sounds to me like it's going to be a food fest.
Mm-hmm.
Join on the inaugural Taste of Haverhill event presented by the Merrimack Valley Chamber of Commerce and the Hungry Beyond Boston. This event kicks off at 6 p.m. on Monday, April 13, at Michael's Function Hall at 12 Alpha Street in Haverhill. The evening will be a celebration of the recipes and the culinary talents across the community. Haverhill's top restaurants, chefs, culinary creators will all be under one roof serving signature samples. That might be of interest. There will be live entertainment and plenty to fill one's plate. Call Michael's Function Hall at 978-373-1991. And that's on April 13.
That's a few months ahead, too.
Yeah. I mean, they don't want you to miss anything. They'll probably have that in the paper for a long time. Mm-hmm. How about if I read the Eagle Tribune opinion page? It says, Supreme Court hands Trump a rare defeat. Last week, the Supreme Court gave the country one notable gift in blocking the Trump administration's efforts to deploy the National Guard to Chicago, part of a campaign of intimidation that has seen troops deploy now to various Democratic areas. Six justices said no to Trump. Chief John Roberts, Sonia Sotomayor, Elena Kagan, Brett Kavanaugh, Amy Coney Barrett, and Ketanji Brown Jackson, while the other three stood with him, Clarence Thomas, Sam Alito, and Neil Gorsuch. That doesn't take the high court off the naughty list. This shadow docket decision is all the more notable for how comically these decisions have so far tilted in favor of Trump. Prior to this ruling, the Supreme Court issued 24 decisions on its emergency docket, of which 20 had gone in favor of Trump administration, often overturning district and circuit court decisions that had sided against on what were sometimes relatively obviously points of law. For the justices to slap down Trump's attempts to use it as a get out of legal compliance free card, something seems to have been both extremely unlawful, as were the efforts to invoke the Alien Enemies Act under insane pretenses and to disregard a federal court order requiring the return of Kilmer Abrego Garcia. We're in sort of a weird posture these days when our federal court system has to take at face value and evaluate legal arguments that are obviously pretextual. In this case, seeing that there was no plausible way to argue that there was a rebellion or an invasion in Illinois, because I think he can deploy the guard if there's some kind of rebellion or invasion.
Yeah, that's what the act says.
The administration hung its hat on the notion that it could not uphold the law in the state without the deployment of the military. The court stopped short of addressing the point of whether order really has broken down in Illinois, but rested it, its order on the president's ability to deploy the National Guard. Beyond the absurd premise that Trump's already legally questionable efforts to use overwhelming force to round up immigrants and native-born citizens, citizen protesters alike could not be carried out by the combined forces of every federal law enforcement agency, the court pointed out that this legal authority just doesn't exist. This extraordinary power can only be invoked when the regular military is not enough to enforce domestic laws, and the military is already barred from enforcing laws on U.S. territory, except in extreme circumstances. For pretty good reasons, countries where armed military is conducting operations on the streets are not often those where things are going well or particularly democratically. Chalk up at least one victory here for the rule of law, among the biggest stress tests in at least 150 years. Unfortunately, the lesson Trump has learned from his decades of lying and cheating in business and then lying and cheating in politics is to always keep punching and prodding regardless of the law, the norms, the ethics, or basic decency. So don't expect this to stop here. They've already been rumblings for a while that some White House factions have been salivating over the prospect of invoking the Insurrection Act out on American streets with the possibility of actually employing force. The courts, one of the few remaining institutional checks on his authoritarian power grabs, must continue to quickly and forcibly slap down the administration's efforts to politically weaponize our military, often seen as a final, conclusive step in consolidating autocratic power, whether it is a district judge or the highest court in the land. Scary? You scared? I'm scared.
It doesn't look good.
No. Okay.
Hail Caesar.
Okay.
All right, so I'll just go. I did have another Trump thing, but I don't know if I can read it. I think I'll go with Today in History and then a couple of small stories out of Nigeria, which has been in the news a lot recently. On this date, which is January 5th, and January 5th, as far back as 1589, Catherine de Medici of France died at the age of 69, and I'm not quite sure who Catherine Medici is. On this date in 1781, a British naval expedition led by Benedict Arnold burned Richmond, Virginia. In 1896, an Austrian newspaper, Wiener Presse, reported the discovery by German physicist Wilhelm Röntgen of a type of radiation that in future came to be known as X-rays. And of course we can't do without X-rays anymore these days. 1914, auto industrialist Henry Ford announced he was going to pay workers $5 for, get this, David, $5 for an 8-hour day.
Wait, oh, sign me up.
As opposed to what was previously going, which was $2.34 for a 9-hour day. So that he doubled the money for those workers. 1925 on this date.
That won't even buy you a slice of pizza today.
Well, I mean, I know it is a long time ago, but they doubling the money for those car workers, that was a pretty big thing.
You're right. Absolutely.
In 1925, Democrat Nellie Taylor Ross of Wyoming took office as America's, this is quite interesting, first female governor, succeeding her late husband, William, following a special election. 1943, educator and scientist George Washington Carver, who was born into slavery, died in Tuskegee, Alabama at the age of 80. And in 1949, in the State of the Union address, President Harry S. Truman labeled his administration the Fair Deal. 1957, President Dwight D. Eisenhower proposed assistance to countries to help them resist communist aggression in what became known as the Eisenhower Doctrine. And in 1972, on January 5th, President Richard Nixon announced that he had ordered the development of the what became known as the Space Shuttle. 1975, The Wiz, a musical version of L. Frank Baum's The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, featured an all-star black cast and opened on Broadway. 1983, President Ronald Reagan announced he was nominating Elizabeth Dole to succeed Drew Lewis as Secretary of Transportation. And Dole became the first woman to head a cabinet department in Reagan's administration and the first to head the Department of Transportation. And 1998, Sonny Bono, the 1960s pop star turned politician, Cher's husband, was killed when he struck a tree while skiing at the Heavenly Ski Resort in the Nevada-California state line. And I just want to mention here a couple of stories about Nigeria very shortly. At least 30 villagers in Minna, Nigeria, were killed, and several others are missing after a gunman raided a village in northern Nigeria's Niger state, police said on Sunday. The latest in a deadly cycle of violence in that region. The gunman stormed into the Kasuwan Daji village in the Borgu local government area on Saturday and just opened fire on residents. They razed down the local market and several houses, said state police spokesman Wazu Abedun. At least two residents put the death toll at 37 and said it could be much higher, as some people remained missing on Sunday. Locals also said that the security forces are yet to arrive in the area, contradicting a police claim they deployed officers to search for those who were kidnapped. The Reverend Father Stephen Kabarat, a spokesman for the Catholic Church of Contagora Diocese, where the attack happened, told local police that the gunman killed more than 40 people and abducted several others. And another bad news story out of Nigeria is in the state of Yobe, a passenger boat capsized in northern Nigeria's Yobe state, leaving at least 25 people dead and 14 others remain missing. The boat was carrying residents who had gone to shop at a local market, as well as those who were involved in fishing and farming along the Yobe River on Saturday night. Out of the 52 passengers on board the boat, 13 were rescued and are receiving medical assistance. Search and rescue operations are ongoing, with security agencies, emergency responders, and local volunteers working tirelessly to locate the missing passengers and recover their bodies. The disaster response agency said the boat overturned mid-journey without offering any additional details. And it finishes by saying that boat accidents kill hundreds of people annually across the country of Nigeria. So if you're there, watch out traveling by boat, I guess.
Hmm. Yeah. Okay. How about Dear Abby? You up for that?
Yes.
Okay. Dear Paul, my husband and I were both male. Okay? You got it? We're both male.
We're both male.
I'm sorry?
Where? They were both male?
Yeah, we're both male.
Oh, we're both male. Okay.
Okay. My husband and I, we're both male. It's in parentheses. We're both male.
Okay.
Have been together since 2007. All right? We moved to Arizona in 2010. Most of our family lives in the Midwest. We have been visiting our families as often as possible, at least every other year. At least every other year. I just read that. Our son-in-law refuses to let us stay the night in his home when we visit. His excuse is he doesn't want to have to explain to his two daughters why we sleep in the same bed. The daughters are 6 and 8. Okay? My husband and I no longer feel comfortable around our son-in-law. And we told our daughter we feel it would be best to skip this year's visit. She offered to put us up in a hotel. Okay? We declined the offer and said we have other friends who we can visit. Our daughter then offered to come and visit us with our granddaughters. We also declined that offer. Are we doing the right thing? We feel the son-in-law is using his daughters as an excuse for his own homophobic feelings towards us. Hey, good luck, Paul.
That's a tough one. I would say ignore what the son-in-law says and take your daughters and go visit these two men.
Right, but they declined to let the daughter and the kids come to their house. Huh. Okay, let's get an answer here. It says, I see nothing positive to be gained by punishing your daughter and your 6 and 8 year old grandchildren who have offered viable alternatives because their father is uncomfortable with their sexual orientation. Let your daughter visit and bring the children. Foster a strong relationship with all of them. If you succeed, your narrow-minded son-in-law may find himself increasingly marginalized.
Go visit. Why not?
Okay, dear Paul, in the past, I always disliked my appearance. Well, you can't apply that to yourself. I have been obese most of my 70 years, but I am now within 20 pounds of my ideal weight. Wow. Ooh. Good for that person. My problem is I have met someone I like very much and could see spending the rest of my life with. And this person's in her 70s.
Ooh.
However, she, I guess this is a male. However, she is obese. It bothers me greatly. How can I effectively communicate my desire that she lose 30 to 50 pounds without being offensive? Oh, my. Well, then why are you hanging with this person? Did you think it was going to be easy, Paul? You know, you said, yeah, I'll answer, dear Abby.
Yeah. So, look, that's not fair to tell her. In either in a subtle way or an unsubtle way that you're fat, you have to lose 50 pounds or I don't want to do with you. I don't know.
Could you just drop, how about if you just put a note in front of her and subtly and say Weight Watchers, 1-800
or Planet Fitness.
All right, here's the answer from dear Abby. She's the professional. Obviously, yeah, okay, you're not giving me the professional answer.
No.
It says approaching someone and saying that you want them to lose 30 to 50 pounds would be like touching the third rail.
Yes.
I agree. You can, however, as you get to know the person better, model your healthy lifestyle
upon her
and encourage her by setting an example.
Yeah.
No, I don't know. If she picks up on it, she may be the lady for you. I don't know. They get a bit more bizarre every time we read these Dear Abby ones. So, well, okay. Yeah. You know what? We're going to end on that note. Yeah. We want to thank you for listening to the Lowell Association for the Blind's LEB Radio. The Lab Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. There are three ways to listen to us on the radio. One, call us at the lab at 978-454-5704, and we can give you a free specialized radio receiver. Another way to listen to us is dial this phone number, 1-631-359-9069. And finally, a way to listen to us is go to our website, LowellAssociationForTheBlind.org. Paul, I want to thank you for reading the Lowell Sun, and it was nice to see you. Yep. It's always enjoyable to read the news with you.
It is. And there's not a lot of it's good, but, you know, you got to do the best you can.
That's true. So we rebroadcast at 4 p.m., and then tomorrow morning we have new readers in at 9 in the morning reading the local newspapers. Bye-bye for now. Going back to Marshfield Broadcasting.